Here we are for a new episode of The Landing, the first ever non-sport episode, and an issue that's really important to me. If you know me, I've definitely probably mentioned it to you along the journey on the issue of EDCs and the environment around us in regards to biodiversity and humans continuing to ignore large issues that have like massive complications for us, like leading into the future. I'm joined here with my uncle, Dr. Matt Landos, the only doctor in the family, I believe.
At this point. At this point.
Yeah, there's still time. It's not me. But I do have a podcast and I thought it'd be awesome to have him on just to have a chat and just welcome a lot of people to the issue, which is very disturbing. But step by step, we'll kind of break it down and get into why it's important that we start thinking about it and what we can do to be better. So Matt, first off, I just want to ask you like what you studied, set the scene in regards to how you fell into this and yeah, set us up.
Yeah, thanks Sully. And I guess I started life early on being a passionate young fisherman, probably in the first days, going out with my dad in a canoe, catching fish, and I loved it. And then I kept loving fishing really quite a lot through my entire youth. It was central, and every holiday was, where are we going? I hope there's water, taking a fishing rod. And then I got to the point where I'm like, I got to do something at university here. I don't know what to step into. I tried out some work experience in a law firm. It wasn't for me. I looked at a bunch of opportunities, and then I thought, well, actually, my ticket out of Canberra at the time where I grew up was to go to vet school in Sydney. And I liked animals. And I was interested very much in fish, but there wasn't really much in the veterinary course about fish at all. But there was a lot about all sorts of other animals. And so I thought, well, I'm going to get into veterinary science. And then at the end of that, it'll give me some choices that might lead me back into my interest in fish. Now, I got wildly distracted along the way. These things can happen at university. There's a lot of distractions. And one of those distractions was the beauty of a dairy cow who have magnificent eyelashes. I don't know whether you've ever seen them, but they're particularly attractive. And I got really into trying to understand dairy production, dairy health, the health of dairy cows and reproduction in dairy cows. It was quite an interest of mine where I was helping cows get pregnant. Was really part of my job. And I enjoyed that work for a number of years and then suffered with a back injury and thought, well, I've got to find a small animal to pick up. These cows are a little bit big and they're really doing damage to my back, so I took the path then back to think about fish. Let's jump back.
It always comes back to fish.
It did. So I sort of circled back around, and I was really fortunate to meet a character who was really formative for me. A guy called Richard Callan. He was a doctor there, a pathologist, who was New South Wales government's only fish pathologist at the time. He was a very wise man, and I got to spend a few years working with him at the laboratory and in the field for New South Wales fisheries at the time. So that gave me an opportunity to begin to understand government and how the machinations of government work, and also start to look at some big disease outbreaks. Big fish kills in the wild were things that I was investigating, and working also with farming. So at the time I began working with developing the silver perch aquaculture industry. I got involved in the prawn aquaculture industry and trying to get them to improve their productivity and become viable businesses. So that was part of my job at the time.
But like more so on the health of the fish as opposed to selling more fish.
Yeah, so it was very much about my kind of niche was make more of them survive, make them grow faster, preferably make them grow cheaper so that there's more margin in the business ultimately at the end. But my focus in state government was very disease-driven, to focus on diagnosing disease.
Yeah,
and the focus particularly in government is around what we call pathogens, which are kind of the bugs, the bacteria, the virus. There was quite a focus on cause being one of those bugs. But my training was a little broader than that, and I knew that really there were several things that could contribute to disease. So there's both the bug, but there's also the state of the host. So if the animal's weak for any reason, then the bug gets an opportunity to climb on top of it. If the environment that the bug's living in and the host is living in is degraded, then that also could go badly for the host and promote the virus or the pest, the parasite, to roll over the top. So it was an interesting dynamic. It's a real dynamic way of understanding how things work in intensive farming systems, but also in the wild. So that kind of fulfilled about 5 years. We knocked around in that position and did a bunch of work, a bunch of research. And then I realised that my aspirations probably were different to some of those within government.
Yeah.
And I set up my own business.
Yeah, so that was where we start with Future Fisheries. And at least something for me, I remember, I think you said 14 years ago, the macadamia case, which was a big case, especially around just our family talking about it over summers and whatnot. And was that the kind of, if you wouldn't mind like elaborating on that case in particular, and if that pushed you in a different direction in regards to what you want to dedicate your career to?
Yeah, so I'd been doing a bunch of different disease investigations in fish hatcheries and different scenarios, and I got a call to attend a case up in Noosa at a native fish hatchery. They were breeding Australian bass and a bunch of other fish species, which were being used for restocking into empowerments for recreational fishing opportunities. And
what does that mean? Just making more fish to put into lakes?
Yeah, so some of these fish, like Australian bass, they don't breed naturally in the lake. They need to actually migrate to yep. breed, and because there's a great big dam wall in the way, that migration's really problematic. But at the same time, the state government and anglers have a desire to go fishing and to utilise this infrastructure that we've put in place. So they've been repurposed, these empowerments, to create recreational opportunities for angling and get people outdoors. I think it's a great thing, fishing. It's a great pastime. And this is something I was pretty keen to support. So I got to this, it's a virtuous circle of things going on here.
Always back to fishing.
It just sort of circles back. And so I was helping this particular lady who was having great trouble with her fish. The breeding was not going well. There was lots and lots of mortality. And she began giving me the full history, which spanned a few years. And it brought to me a new issue that I hadn't thought about as a cause of disease and as a cause of reproductive failure. And this was, in this case, it was exposure to tiny amounts of spray drift. So the macadamia orchard, which happened to fringe very close to her operation, in fact, she was flanked on three sides by this particular farm. It had been an organic operation in its original, quite a number of years, it ran as an organic farm. And during that time, it's interesting, she had no problems breeding her fish.
Wow.
When they
upsized.
Yeah, the farm changed hands to different operators and they moved to a conventional farming system, which was largely following guidance that state governments do provide about this is how you grow macadamias. If you get pest bug number A, then you spray chemical B. If you get pest C, you spray chemical D. And this is how we grow macadamias. It's formulaic. And this is what the new operation started doing. The problem was that when they were applying these chemicals, the fish were trying to breed. It was breeding season for the fish. And this is, it turns out, a particularly sensitive time for development. And there's some very, very critical signalling going on between the cells of an embryo. And fish are quite a unique chance to see what's going on because they don't have a uterus like humans do, where it's all going on internally. We don't get to see the developing embryo. But in fish, they spawn their eggs externally. And so you can place them in a petri dish, put them under a microscope, and you can watch the cells dividing.
Just see what happens.
Yeah, the eggs are actually transparent. So you can watch as the embryo does its thing in trying to develop inside a fertilised egg. And what was happening in this case is we were able to watch that development become deranged. We saw abnormalities forming in these larvae. Some of them didn't develop their eyes. Some of them got fluid around their heart that meant that their heart wouldn't be functioning terribly well and they were dying. We saw fish, the extreme case, we saw fish developing two heads with one body.
And just to quickly play devil's advocate, obviously it's such a complicated process in bringing life in any organism, but it was happening at a rate that was higher than kind of like the natural amount, because obviously things would go wrong anyway. But I just wanted to kind of like ask you, like, it was abnormal rates of mutations and whatnot.
Yeah, that's right. And you're quite correct. There's often some embryos, particularly in fish, where we see a small proportion will be not viable for a range of reasons. Things will go wrong and that embryo will terminate and will die. But what we were seeing is rates that were extremely high, well over 90%, and in some cases 100% mortality within a couple of days of fertilisation. So this was worst case scenario, colossally bad levels of problems. So we started really investigating that, and the way to do it is to have really an open investigation template. Initially, all causes have to be on the table, and you try and gather evidence to rule things in or out and try and build your confidence about cause. So that's the process that we embarked on, and we started noticing other things at the farm. So we noticed that the chickens on the farm had deformed toes. So that's really odd. Why would a chicken have deformed toes? And then we saw dead honeybees lying on the ground. So why would a honeybee die on the ground right here? What does that mean about what's coming from the macadamia orchard into this fish hatchery?
Yeah.
We started seeing frogs that had deformed back legs developing as tadpoles. Like, that's very odd. Why do frogs get deformed legs? So I started getting a whole lot of questions that I didn't have answers to straight up. I was like, that's just plain weird. And to have all of those things happening at the same time in the same place.
Yeah, but what was consistent is all happening to all the life in this particular area.
In this particular spot. This is really concerning. And then it kind of didn't even end there. So we had other animals that were aborting. So they were miscarrying their pregnancies early term, or giving birth to dead puppies, for example. There was a dog on the property who was pregnant, and she gave birth to dead pups, and then she gave birth to pups with no eyes. So this was all quite troubling and led me to really embark on a pretty deep level of reading about science that I hadn't been taught. It wasn't something that was in my undergraduate degree. It wasn't something I'd stumbled across in my first 8 or 9 years of being in practice. So I was pretty disturbed, really, is the word, by what I found. And it became difficult in that case, because the more convinced I became about cause, the less it appeared that the state government wanted to help to fix anything. And that was deeply concerning to me, because both it meant my client couldn't fix her problem, so she couldn't functionally produce fish in her hatchery, so she was going to be out of business. And I had a wider thought, though. Well, if it's happening here, what's happening in the wider fishery?
On the bigger farms, on
everywhere. Yeah, what's happening with waterways everywhere, and kind of what's happening with water? Because at the time I was very aware as an angler that there's lots of public speaking going on about overfishing, people catching all the fish, commercial fishermen being branded as archetypal evil who were catching all the fish, and this is why the fish were disappearing. And it occurred to me that maybe that wasn't true, that actually was anybody really considering what the role of tiny doses of chemicals could be on developing embryos that you can't see without a microscope in a river?
Yeah, they're not catching all the fish. There's just no fish.
They're just not there. Yeah. They're not coming through. And so this was quite disturbing. And I actually went and met a local commercial fisherman. He's a lovely guy. He's passed away now. But commercial fishermen have incredible knowledge from a lifetime of on-water experience. This guy had been fishing for 40 years in the Noosa Lakes. So his entire life had been on the one farm, fishing the one lot of shots with the same nets for 40 years.
40 years, yeah.
And he knew his fishery really well. And I said, look, well, just tell me what you've seen. What's happened to your catches? And he goes, well, some fish have just disappeared. He said, these pink-eye mullet, they've disappeared. These snub-nosed garfish, they used to be prolific. I hardly see them now. He said, and we used to catch, incidentally, tons of Australian bass. Inadvertently, we'd get them. and he used to really hate them because they're very spiky. So he had to get them out of his nets and release them legally. He couldn't sell them. So he got tons of spikes in his hands, so he really didn't like catching them. So he was trying to actively avoid catching them. But he said inevitably in some years he'd still get a ton of bass in his net. But now that never happened. He was lucky if he caught 6 or 7 bass in a net. So he was suggesting that there was really a huge decline in population in the river environment of this same farm. And it really got me to thinking, oh, goodness me, what's going on here with water and how we're regulating some of these compounds? So I tried very earnestly, thinking that I could, through a dent of my persistence with government, provide information that would help change what was happening and move towards safety so that we could have both land practices, both businesses operating. I'm far from anti-farming. In fact, my whole business is farming. So I didn't want there to be conflict. I wanted there to be a resolution where operations could operate.
Yep.
But that wasn't the outcome that government were particularly keen on. So we chose a little different pathway to try and agitate in the end. And I was very fortunate to have a friend who helped out with a YouTube that we put up about the bass in the Noosa River and the decline, and it got sent out to a bunch of angling groups who, when they had the pieces assembled for them, they were quite upset.
They kind of realised, oh, this is happening to all of us.
This could be a problem here. So they started agitating, and we did get a bigger inquiry started through government then. So, I mean, to his credit at the time, Minister Tim Mulheron did start a task force to look into what was happening in the Noosa River. And it was not an easy process because there were really two sets of very divergent views of the people on the task force. But we, over a year, and, you know, it's a pretty big love job, this sort of thing, early to take on in your career. I don't necessarily recommend it. But I learnt a lot about, you know, how much integrity, how important integrity was to maintain your own, and at times how little integrity government could have in these meetings where minutes came out that didn't reflect what was said, where people were really quite disingenuous about their motives. So that was educative for me at the time. I was very green.
An important life lesson.
Definitely a life lesson.
An unfortunate one.
Yeah, look, sometimes the unfortunate can be the best. And look, I think that case that spanned quite some time, so they did get to a final report that they released publicly, and appended to that, albeit after the event, they accidentally forgot to append my report and the report of another veterinary pathologist. They did get appended subsequently, but the report itself had a whole lot of recommendations, and most of them actually were about spraying chemicals. So whilst the headline said, "We can't prove definitively that any of what happened was caused by chemicals," recommendation one, we recommend that the following safe spray practices be reviewed. Recommendation two, so there was this pile of recommendations which spoke to need to control agricultural pesticide application.
Without actually condemning anyone that doesn't do that.
Yeah, without actually saying it was the problem.
Yeah.
You're saying it's the problem, because if there was no problem with spraying, there would be no recommendations about spraying. But the reality is there's some serious problems with what we're doing with agrichemicals. So that was a bit of a gateway moment, like low moment, a whole lot of moments really, all kind of slap yourself in the face moment.
Yeah.
And things like that, you can't really forget.
And that kind of set you on, I need to dedicate my life towards this issue.
Well, I kept on with my business in aquaculture and wild capture fisheries. But with this new knowledge, I was able to see deeper into problems. And what it allowed me to do through just really reading was discover that there's this whole body of science that people had been beavering on earnestly all around the world. Scientists had really begun to discover that our body operates with hormones.
And this is late 2000s?
Yeah, so this was late 2000s for me.
And just quickly, what ended up happening to the macadamia, the story?
So
can
look,
you just finish that up.
Yeah. So look, the farm itself, because the conflict was not resolved, she was unable to actually profitably operate the farm. The farm ended up being resumed by the bank. There was a legal case that took place between the hatchery operator and the insurer of the macadamia farm, and I understand some settlement was arrived at between the parties, as I understand, in favour of the fish hatchery. But there was no change to the spraying practices, which were what was required to make the hatchery viable again.
It was just, oh, we recommend you don't spray as much.
Yeah.
Moving on.
And unfortunately, what they were able to say, hand on heart, was that you are using the product according to the label, and the legislation only requires that you do use it according to the label. So you haven't broken a law.
Not even taking into the account that the label could be wrong.
Correct. Yeah. So these are kind of loopholes, really, in our legislation that are regulatory gaps.
Yeah.
That lead to unfortunate consequences, like for this fish hatchery. The lady subsequently developed cancer, so her story continued to get worse. Her dog actually continued to have deformed puppies and stillborn puppies years later. And this was really more lessons. The lessons kind of kept coming from this case. Now, she moved properties to another property only probably about 10 kilometres away. She did exactly the same things. She moved her tanks, moved her air pumps, and started breeding fish without a neighbour that was a spraying farm. And she bred hundreds of thousands of fish successfully.
Unbelievable.
Again.
Wow.
So immediately upon moving, she completely recovered productivity of her hatchery, which really spoke to her ability as a hatchery operator to produce fish, that she could actually generate fish.
And just confirmed all the kind of suspicions you had.
Yeah, so yeah. It really spoke to this issue of it was a site-based issue and that there was something at that site causing the deformed development.
Yeah.
So, and then I came across the term through this time over endocrine disrupting chemical. And I'd been taught the word endocrine at uni. It was a word.
Yeah, I had in year 11 biology as well.
Yeah, yep. So it kind of taught me really it was a hormone, which is probably a word we in more common usage for an endocrine substance. It's a hormone, something that our body secretes, so we manufacture it naturally. Now, we've got a bunch of different hormones that make our bodies operate. So we have the sex hormones, your testosterone, your estrogen. So these are pretty well known. We have some that help women lactate. So these are different hormones. We've got hormones that help us get glucose into our cells, so things like insulin.
Yeah.
These are also hormone substances or endocrine substances. Then we have thyroid hormone. So we have lots of these things.
Just
now,
to make you do something.
Yeah, this is the operating system for a body. It tells the cells how fast to go, how slow to go, how much to replicate.
When you should eat, when you shouldn't eat.
Turns it on and off. Yeah. All this signalling is going on. Little chemical signals are charging around our bodies between our brain and our body parts telling them what to do. And those messages are at tiny concentrations of chemical. It's really quite extraordinary how little chemical is needed to make us operate.
Yeah.
So, you know, for kind of maleness, if I was looking just at testosterone, if I had sort of around 70 nanograms per litre of testosterone, so that's a nanogram's 10 to the minus 9. So it's a frighteningly small amount.
Jack shit.
it's a fragment of testosterone, then yes, I could be daddy. But if I dropped just maybe 20 nanograms a litre, dropped down to 50, then I'd be all cuddles. There'd be no baby making. It wouldn't be happening.
Wow.
Because that hormone is critical for manufacture of sperm. It's critical to control behaviour. It modifies behaviour. So this is the incredibly fine tolerance that our bodies operate on. And then what I learnt was that this endocrine system could be disrupted. And so this is where the term an endocrine disrupting chemical came from. So these were chemicals that either acted like hormones or could antagonize hormones, could block them or get into the receptor or mess up the messaging between things. And suddenly when you open the door to endocrine disrupting chemicals, you realize it's a really big room you're walking into of science, and you realize, ooh, there's some important things in this room. And so that's really begun...
Staples of life, like just...
Become quite a chapter, yeah. Because if you upset those things, you certainly can alter your own personal health trajectory. But if we look out to my beloved fishing, you can certainly alter the amount of fish I get to catch.
Yeah.
Which ultimately was important to me all the way through. Probably still is. And a source of frustration if I go fishing and I can't catch anything. Realizing that, in fact, tiny doses of chemicals could be a contributor to this problem, as well as catching too much, as well as habitat loss and other complexities. But this was one that wasn't front and center. It wasn't being publicly discussed. And most importantly, it wasn't being managed.
Well, it's invisible.
It's invisible.
Because you can't, like, you go for a swim, you have no idea if you're swimming through something that you're taking into your body. You have no idea. You can't think about what's going into your body at all times. Like, you can think about food and drink, but even then, like, we don't know exactly what's in it.
That's right.
That's the scariest thing about it, yeah.
Yeah, so, and even now we know that, you know, there's many air pollutants that act as endocrine disruptors. So we know that some of our indoor air spaces, for example, when we now have the analytical technology to tell us what's in that air. We can sample these chemistries that appear in the air that come out of our carpet, that might come out of devices we've got plugged in the wall to make things smell. They might come out of our furnishings and our fixings in the building. But they end up in the air, and, of course, we breathe them in.
Yeah.
Again, invisible, but not neutral. These are biologically active. And this is something that was not at all apparent to me before this case. And even during the case, I was really beginning a journey of discovery about what all this meant. How important was it? Was this a one-off case that just was an isolated incident, you know, that was just unfortunate? But it turns out that hasn't been the case. It's been getting bigger.
And it's happened on so many different levels. Yeah. In regards to just like a local case, someone spraying their vegetable garden, and then also can apply it to like a larger scale, just with like massive farms and whatnot.
Yeah, so we're starting to see now the impacts out to things like biodiversity.
Yep.
So when we stretch out now, I mean, I can remember family holidays as a kid in the old Kingswood. We'd hitch the old Franklin caravan on the back and we'd travel. We'd go out west through agricultural country, cropping land, but we'd have to stop at a service station every couple of hundred Ks to fill up the car. And there was a guy there at the servo who was a windscreen washer man. It was a job. And the reason he had to wash your windscreen is because it was covered in bugs and you couldn't see. There was so many squash bugs on your windscreen. And what's happened over time is the number of bugs have basically disappeared. You don't even need a windscreen washer man no more.
I can remember literally as a kid driving up to Canberra to visit, and the Prado would just be covered in bugs when you arrived. And I went up to Canberra 3 weeks ago and there's way less.
The bugs are on the way out, right? And you're like, oh, well, no bugs. I hate mosquitoes. Probably a good thing. But then when you get into biology, you realize, oh, those bugs, they're kind of important. And if you're into fishing, you realize, oh, those bugs, they're fish food. And
it's part of the food chain.
Yeah, they're real important, it turns out, those bugs. They cycle nutrients around in our food webs for us.
Well, look at the bee movie.
Yeah, that's right. So these are super important animals. So when you start looking out in rural Australia and you see that our pollinators, like bees, but there's many of them. Bees are the kind of, I guess, the poster child of pollinators for us. But there's a lot of other pollinators that are insects, but they're declining. In real terms, they're declining. And that has serious implications because you're talking between 30 and 40% of all food requires pollination.
Wow.
So where do we go if we're on this pathway to eliminating pollinators? This seems like a ticket to nowhere. So this is where the kind of winding path leads you. When you start on some of this stuff, you begin to learn that, well, why are the bees declining? Oh, a tiny dose of chemical affects their ability to find their way home.
Yeah, I was about to say, is the kind of homeostasis for these sort of animals just way, like, kind of skinnier compared to humans? Is that why they're dying and getting mutated as much? And obviously we'll get into human fertility as well. But is that because they're just way more fragile?
Well, there's different. Sometimes it's about the level of exposure that's happening. And so obviously if you're a bug and you're in a paddock that gets directly sprayed, you've got some pretty high exposure happening. So that can drive more impacts. But with the drift issues of chemical moving from the place where it was planned to be put somewhere else, and we know that it can move now tens of kilometres from where it was put, depending on the chemistry and the weather conditions, we know that drift actually goes a long way. We know this mostly, well, two ways we know it, I guess. One is that we hear about different groups saying, look, vegetation on my property is dying and I didn't spray.
Yeah.
Why is it dying? It's dying, and it looks like it's dying of spray drift because you've got spots on the leaves and the leaves are dying, and I've had a pathologist look at my leaves and he says it looks like herbicide damage. You're like, where'd the herbicide come from? Miles away. So this stuff moves, and it moves in that invisible way in the landscape, causing these exposures. And whilst we see these things very directly in insects, they're also affecting fish as the next kind of step up the chain, you might think, in food webs. But they're affecting invertebrates. So things like crayfish, Murray River crayfish, are declining. If you look over in Western Australia, marin, the WA marin, the big, nice, big, tasty freshwater crayfish, is declining. And I had another case there actually in WA where a vineyard got set up next to a marin farm. So the guy had been pioneering marin farming with the state government for more than 20 years. So he had a tremendous amount of data on his farm about how many marin do I put in a pond and what happens when I put that many in, how much food do I need to give them, how much aeration, how much water change, how often, how long will it take and how big will they get and how many do I get out. So he'd done iterations of that across tens of ponds for 25 years. So he kind of had it down. He knew what he was going to get. The system was pretty stable. And then a neighbour came along and said, I want to put in a vineyard. And he said, no, you can't do that. That's gonna create a real risk for my little sensitive marin. They're not good with chemicals.
Well, he said that.
Yeah, he said that before they'd set up. And they said, well, look, we're allowed to set up. We're operating within the law. We're doing things according to the label. Therefore, we say it'll be fine.
Which is... As like a part of like a just kind of listening to the government, that's not wrong in thinking that. If you apply that to a lot of different scenarios, if you're not doing anything wrong, like it's technically fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, just going back to maybe the label's wrong.
Yeah, and so we got to this point where, well, actually, hang on, what's going on?
That'd be
now?
A good campaign name.
Yeah.
Maybe the label's wrong.
Yeah, maybe the label is wrong, and then you begin to understand what sits behind the label. Like, how do we even get to the label? What's the process? So there's a risk assessment that gets done. Okay, right. So what goes into the risk assessment? And then you realise that not everything goes into the risk assessment. Most of what gets considered are documents supplied by the person seeking to register the compound. So they can fund and perform their own trials for their product that they wish to get registered. And whilst there's some obligation to look wider at other, you might call them independent studies or other studies, these often aren't considered with the same weighting. And this leads to a process where science can get skipped over or not read or not considered.
We're just fast-tracked.
Yeah.
Because even like this whole issue, we're finding out about it too late. Like it's after the fact. When if there was more kind of regulations in place to go through a process before it got put on shelves or before it could even be bought or sprayed or whatever, but instead we're kind of chasing our tail.
Yeah, and Australia doesn't really have a particularly proud record in this regard. We're very slow to make regulatory change, certainly compared to other parts of the world. So in Europe, they've really begun to recognise the endocrine disrupting potential of pesticides as one class of endocrine disruptor. And it's important, I think, probably to say that there's many endocrine disruptors, and things like plastics and plasticizers are another big group of endocrine disruptors.
Is there a so with these chemicals, can they be removed, or like, is there a level? Because obviously you're going to take some into your body regardless of just walking around, just drinking, just whatever. But is there a level that we're able to kind of live with? Or is, like, if you, for example, the macadamia case, if that lady, because I assume she took in a lot of chemicals from just working there, if she moved to a spot which was fully, she like thought about like what she ate, what she drank, like what chemicals were around her, does your body fight it?
Well, look, some of the chemistries, and it's a bit variable with the particular chemical, but some of them go in and out quite quickly of our bodies. So they don't necessarily hang around. So some of the common ones, like glyphosate, they go in and out of our body fairly quickly. So you would say that they're not a cumulative type poison that build up over time.
Yep.
But the issue with some like glyphosate is that they're so widely present in things that it's like being exposed every day anyway. So it's like pseudo-accumulation. Where
you might not hold it, but you're still getting it every day.
Yeah, so yep. Before the last bit's gone, you've just put the next bit in. And so you end up with quite protracted exposures. And we have a food safety system that's designed to identify residues of pesticides in food and say that there's a safe level. They try and determine what's called a maximum residue limit food.
Yeah, what I was kind of like trying to ask you.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's a way that the regulatory system's supposed to be looking out. They kind of take a look at what we eat too and say, oh, you know, you don't eat 6 punnets of strawberries, so we'll work out how much does the average person eat, and we'll say that that's an acceptable daily intake based on a certain commodity that might have a certain residue profile depending on what was put in it. Now, there's many problems with that system where it hasn't adequately considered endocrine disruptor endpoints. The thing about the endocrine disruptor story is that often the impacts happen at lower doses than what the regulatory system considered. So the system very much regulates on acute toxicity. So if you drank a heap of chemical and you fell over and died, that's acute toxicity, right? So that's the first bar that a chemical's got to get over. They then do consider what they might call chronic toxicity. There's some consideration about cancer forming, some consideration of some other areas of impact on being genotoxic and so on. But the bar is actually set quite high. Quite low, really. So in terms of, we don't look at super sensitive endpoints. These are coarse endpoints that we look at to set regulation. So when the discoveries of endocrine disrupting effects of pesticides were beginning to be written about in the 90s and through the early 2000s, this storm of literature started coming out saying, hey, look, when you do a study and you set the dose rates, you might do what we call a dose ranging study. You say, okay, I'm going to expose some animals at 1 milligram a kilo, at 10 milligrams a kilo, and at 100. And let's just say the 100 ones fall over dead. Well, that's clearly unsafe. The 10s, about 20% of them get sick, but they don't die. And the ones look okay.
Let's go with the ones.
You say, well, one looks like it's safe. We call it safe. Yeah, but we didn't test 0.1.
Over like a long time as well. Like,
no, and we didn't test it at all, whether it's over a long or a short time. And the funny thing about hormones or endocrine effects is that they are not dose related. So intuitively we would think that 1 milligram is 10 times worse than 0.1, but that's not how hormone responses work. And so what we've seen is those types of relationships in dosing, they call them monotonic dosing, which is back to an old chemist, Paracelsus, actually back in, I think we're back somewhere in the 1500s, talked about the dose equals the poison, was kind of his mantra. But it turns out that in endocrine effects, the dose doesn't actually equal the poison, and you can get what we call non-monotonic effects, where you get a big effect at a very low dose, then no effect at a higher dose, and then a big effect again at another higher dose.
Jeez.
So it's an unusual relationship between dose and effect. And the regulatory system and the food safety system has very poorly attempted to assess this risk. And essentially it's not functional in our food system. So it's problematic around the residues, and that presumes that everyone's doing the right thing, as in that all the food that reaches market is below the residue limit. That's what should be happening. If the labels are working, if the farmers are all doing the right thing, the food should all be compliant. Now, we haven't had very much surveillance to say, is anyone checking? Have we got a cop on the beat for this particular issue? And the answer is, to a large extent, not really. Now, about a decade ago, the Commonwealth did have the thought bubble, maybe we should check Australian produce and just see if it's compliant. And recently in The Guardian, they published the results of that study, which was never brought to light at the time. So it was, well, you could say perhaps it was buried, but wow. It certainly wasn't promoted in any way to the public or communicated. They found that 12.6% of the produce that they tested was above the maximum residue limit. So it had unsafe, according to food guideline, levels of chemical in it. Some of the chemicals were 70 to 90 times over over the maximum residue limit. So there were strawberries that they were testing that had huge levels of toxic organophosphates in them that would certainly be enough to impair the health of a person who ate them, and particularly hazardous if that someone who ate them was a pregnant woman. The hazard for her fetus was much higher than for her. So if you can imagine, they work these things out via a dose rate. They say, oh, you know, if a human is, say, let's say we've got a mother and she's a 60 kilo, 70 kilo woman. What's the dose rate that's safe for her? She might be able to tolerate that 0.1 of a milligram per kilo. That
yep.
could be safe. Let's say that's the level. But what about the fetus? If it's only 2 cells or 4 cells, how much does the fetus weigh? Because it's sharing the mother's blood. So whatever her exposure was, well, in a dose per kilo for the fetus, it's a much bigger dose yep. per kilo.
Yeah.
And what we understand from the science is that
it's not even a kilo.
It's nowhere near a kilo. Yeah. It's not even a gram.
Wow.
It's a fragment of a gram.
That was all of it.
Yeah. And so its exposure turns out that it can be enough to change the way that those cells develop and can have a number of consequences for that developing embryo. And whether that embryo is a fish embryo or a frog embryo or a rabbit or a rat or a human embryo, the effects that we see are really quite common because that pattern of development, we say, is shared evolutionary biology. So this is when we get back into kind of, you know, the stuff that excited me as a kid was dinosaurs and this kind of history of evolution and how did we get here and what developed into what. And then you realize, well, if we as humans, our real forefathers crawled out of the water, everything started in the water and then things started crawling out, then some things started flying and some things kind of developed fur. And then eventually somewhere down the track when mammals got going, Homo sapiens popped out. But our lineage started back in the water and it started as a fish. They were the first vertebrate animals. And all these vertebrates that have a spine, they have the same running gear in terms of hormones. They've just spun off
in different directions.
Yeah, sure, yeah. There's a few differences. You know, I don't have fins, I've got fingers. You know, there's a few minor changes there, but actually what's remarkable is the similarity that we share with the animal kingdom and the running gear. So what I talk about, when I say running gear, I'm meaning the hormone systems that operate the body.
Yeah.
Is incredibly common. It's held, it's preserved evolutionary through time. And so what we see is fish have testosterone. Fish have estrogen. Fish have insulin. Fish have thyroid hormone. And they're almost identical to ours.
Yeah.
And so we become less surprised then when we start seeing effects across the animal kingdom that are similar.
And it's happening, yeah, it's happening to us as well. Yeah.
So that kind of, you know, it's this thing of, oh, actually we're not separate to this world. We are within the world, we're within the ecology. And if those exposures that are happening to those other animals are also happening to us, then perhaps we should begin to look at some of our current public health changes that might need to be reinterpreted.
Yeah.
And thought about more deeply about what's driving them in terms of cause.
So bringing that back to a more kind of human focus, in regards to, so obviously the process of having a baby, having a fetus, is there effects other than just like pregnant ladies and fetuses, or is it like across the whole board? Like obviously we've heard about the lack of like sperm, the lower sperm count, and was it halved since 1990, or there's a lot of different stats, but could you kind of elaborate on that?
Yeah, look, so it's not all on the ladies, that's for sure. And there's differential impacts, so impacts that are gender specific. So the outcome of an exposure is not the same for different genders to different chemicals. They can have different consequences, but neither of them have nil. And neither of them bring nil to the party when you're talking about making babies. So with men, what we do know is that sperm counts are declining. So a professor in the US has assimilated a lot of data from around the world, so many, many countries, and she's really definitively shown that sperm counts have dropped by more than 50%. Her data went back to 1973, and that was through to 2011, her initial work. She's just updated that recently to 2021.
Oh, no.
And, yeah, unfortunately, the story's not getting better. So up to 2011, she was documenting declines at about 1% a year in sperm count reduction. And now that appears to be accelerating in some countries to up to 2.6% decline in sperm count a year. So this is quite a profound change in the fertility of men, where you become quite literally shooting blanks.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to get pregnant and you're bringing blanks to the party, it's real hard to have a baby and conceive. But it's more than that, because you can change the package that you're delivering in your sperm that can bring changes to that developing fetus that are encoded in the sperm that you transfer. So the man's exposures matter to what happens to the quality, you might think about, of his sperm.
Yeah.
That's bringing its information to the party with the egg to then make the new embryo.
Yeah, because that was the thing that scared me the most. Like where I kind of learnt about this through you was when we were in New Zealand for Nana's 70th.
Yeah.
Yep. Just careful. Yeah. And we would stay up and have some beers, and you'd go through some of your lectures that you'd give, whether it's at a conference or a uni or whatever it was. Because I think that's what's important is obviously there's a lot of science in what you're talking about, but at least for me, like I've always like wanted to have kids and like looked forward to that, and that's the thing that just scared the shit out of me.
Yeah.
And it's such a big issue, because even talking about your fertility is just a bit,
it's a little taboo.
It is. And like, yeah, even like talking to you, like I'm for all, like I like think I'm all good, but I don't know. And it's kind of like scary to even think about. So I think we really do need to push for people to talk about it more, because it literally is our life and like our next generation's life.
Yeah. So we know things are changing dramatically, and there's some signals out there, but often we don't listen to them in the right way. So if we're in the finance sector, we might notice that there's some really good stocks to invest in, like Monash IVF clinic, going gangbusters. Well, why would a fertility clinic be expanding? Why would that happen? I mean, back in the 60s, we invented the pill because the problem was it was way too easy to get pregnant.
Far too easy.
Far too easy. And part of the liberation of women was through access to the pill to control their own fertility. It gave them choices that they didn't have before that, or that were much harder. But all of a sudden, we've got this situation where now, you know, somewhere around one in six couples are needing to seek fertility treatment to have a child. When I was trying to have a child earlier on, perhaps I wasn't trying to have a child, but there was a risk I could have had a child. You know, it was quite cheap. A couple of beers at the pub, I could have been dad on the oval on the way home. I mean, it was cheap. And now the cost is very high. If you enter into IVF, you're looking at thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars.
To try.
To try without a guarantee of success and without consequence. There are consequences when you put fertility treatment drugs into your body that may not be great. We see issues with mental health, depression. We see relationship breakups that happen after people may be unable to get pregnant. And these are really important social problems that we can be creating around what is an infertility problem, around what part of the storyline is about, well, what are we doing to the health of our bodies? How are we protecting ourselves and our fertility?
Like why we're getting more unhealthy.
Yeah, what is going on with that? And kind of, you know, for me it's kind of, why aren't we talking about it? I know it's tricky territory. I spoke recently with a lady who's just written a book about miscarriage. So it's another, just it's a taboo topic. It's not something, it's certainly not something you'll hear men talk about. Women may talk about it, but again, it's not like top of the pops priority to bring up at the party about, oh, I'm just miscarried this week. That's not going to feature.
Yeah.
But what's happening is miscarriage rates appear to be climbing. And so when we talked earlier about, you know, the risk of the development of a fetus going wrong and then it not being progressing, the body choosing to terminate that particular embryo development, in a woman, that can translate to miscarriage, where that embryo does not go to full term and ceases to develop. It's incredibly traumatic for women. There's huge hormonal fluxes that happen. For the family, it's hugely traumatic because you're very invested in the idea that you're going to have a family.
Yeah.
It's very natural to be invested in that. And when there is loss, it's real. It's tangible loss. It's not like losing your car keys. It hits you, and to have that going up and up and up, it's something we've got to start to talk about. So look, I applaud Isabel for putting her book together. I thought it was really brave to begin that discussion.
What was that called?
I haven't got the title off the top of my head actually.
I'll put it in the bio of the pod.
Yeah, but in case they want to read it, yeah. It's certainly got some interesting content in there. And it does touch on some of these issues about things that are changing pregnancy for women and helping educate and inform better some of the issues in this particular area.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. We're going to discuss the next segment of the pod and probably have a focus on something that Matt's getting together in regards to water and how important it is to life. And we'll get to that after this.